It's high on a mountain, the warm winds are blowing, and where the winds are blowing to, there ain't no way of knowing. The mountain grass is short, it's dry and close to burning, crying out for water as the season's turning. Sweet smell of the pines, tall western cedar, drifting on the wind through the mountains like a river.
Hello, my name is Ayanna Young, and I welcome you to Unlearn and Rewild, where we explore radical ideas relating to earth renewal. Today we're speaking with Martine Prechtel, who is a leading thinker, writer, and teacher, whose work, both written and oral, hopes to promote the subtlety, irony, and pre-modern vitality hidden in any living language. As a half-blood Native American with a Pueblo Indian upbringing, his life took him from New Mexico to the village of Santiago Atitlan, Guatemala, there becoming a full village member of the Zutuhil Mayan population. He eventually served as a principal in that body of village leaders, responsible for instructing the young people in the meanings of their ancient stories through the rituals of adult rites of passage. Once again residing in his native New Mexico, Martin teaches at his international school, Bolad's Kitchen. Through story, music, ritual, and writing, Martin helps people in many lands to retain their diversity while remembering their own sense of place in the daily sacred through the search for the indigenous soul. For more information, visit floweringmountain.com. Hello, Martine. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello.
I'm so excited to have you on the show and hear about your incredible experiences and visions for the future.
Oh, you bet. I was just listening to all that. I said, boy, I better live up to it.
Well, your book certainly did. All of the books that I've read have made me think anew.
Yeah.
So I'd like to begin by asking you to give us a little introduction to the Pueblo Nation and the Zutuhil Maya that you lived with. How can we begin to grasp how these people see the world and their purpose in it, their cosmology, if you will?
Well, first of all, I grew up in New Mexico. The reservation, Pueblo Reservation, there's 19 Pueblos in New Mexico, and they're divided by different language groups. You know, anthropologists divide them like this, and Native people divide themselves like that. Matter of fact, the village I grew up in, today is their biggest ceremonial day. I didn't go because I had an interview, but it's enormously based on feeding spiritually the world that feeds us. And New Mexico, because in this area, you know, before it was called New Mexico and it's all Native, the main issue is always water. And so all of the rituals, non-Indians always used to make fun of everybody. Oh, they're doing the rain dance thing or something like that. It's based on the idea that grief of being a human being ends up being tears, dependent on whether or not there is water in your blood veins, in the tree leaves, in the ground, in the air, in the snow. But in winter, we really depend on the snow here. And so I grew up very lucky, and also not knowing I was lucky. I'm not a Pueblo Indian. My mother was a native person from her people, who are mostly Canadian Indians of various and sundry types, you know, Hurons and Anishinaabe, hunting Crees, and so on and so forth, with a lot of painful history. So I didn't really grow up with those cultures, but because my mother was, mostly Native, she got a job teaching Indians when, you know, an Indian was an Indian. So she got a job teaching on one of the reservations. But they were old time. I hesitate to use the word conservative because that brings up right-wing Republicans, which they're not. But they're keeping their things alive, not in a kind of dried-in stuff, the revivalist way. But with them, it never died. And they're one of the most famous Pueblos for having done that. As a result, they don't like to be broadcast or be talked about or anything like that. There's still no photography. There's still no recording. There's no sketching. It's really old-fashioned. I was a little cute little kid there, and everybody liked me, and I grew up there. And so I was lucky to speak. They have their own language called Kiwa. And I grew up speaking that. And then the thing about these languages is that inside the languages themselves, they could put you in prison, they could cut off your arms, they could take away everything from you. But if you have the language, you can still speak and understand the world in a way that is indigenous. So that was the main thing growing up, was that my mother was the first person in this territory of the Southwest to introduce English as being something that was a second language. It was always, you know, thought that English was a language and everything else would be eventually eradicated, which is, and Native people here didn't go for it, thank goodness. And so she was teaching it from another point of view, and I was her test group. She was asking me, how come all these Indians say this instead of that, and how come they say it like this instead of that, and da, da, da. And I said, well, actually, you see, in this language, there's no he, she, or it. So you don't have a he, you don't have an it, you don't have a she, but you have a woman, female word. In other words, a word that belongs only to women. The only women speak it, but only men understand it. You got words that belong only to men. The only men speak and only men understand it. And yet, you know, and all these different things. So then when you translate into English, you know, you get kind of pigeon talk, which I still kind of speak, to be honest. And proudly, I say in English, and because I never held English to be the sovereign language. I held it to be a language, which I have since worked as hard as I can to subvert into an indigenous tongue, which is why I write the way I do. But as far as Mayan people go, they're very far away. I mean, by miles, if it's calculated, I mean, the closest to Tuxila is, well, actually, I don't know where this goes. Tuxila could be one in San Francisco, but that's probably about 3,500 miles or 3,000 miles from here. But culturally, it's a mystery. Always has been a mystery to me why there is so much corroboration of the way of thinking and being between central Guatemalan Indians and a lot of Indian people, Native people who are from central Rio Grande region. Their speech is probably not related. I mean, I think some people are related one style to another style, but it's like so remote. But as far as the mind and the beautiful set of human position in the world, there's a lot of similarities. And they also have similar history with the, what you might call the European interruption into their culture, which in this case was Spanish, not Spanish culture as much as it was Spanish government. And the funny thing about the Spanish, as opposed to the English and the French and the Danes and Portuguese and all these other people that go around, you know, at that time or around the Renaissance and afterwards, is that the Spaniards weren't interested in annihilating all the population. They were interested in actually having a huge population that paid tribute, whereas these other groups wanted to get rid of or enslave the local populations. The Spaniards, for all their faults and for all the terror that they wreaked havoc everywhere, actually kept a lot of good records and also made the native tongues the national language. Like in Guatemala in the 1600s, it was required for all Spaniards to be able to speak Cachiquel, which is one of the most populous languages being spoken even there today. And there's, what, 1.5 million speakers, maybe 2 million. Tutuhil, very small, something like 60,000 people speak Tutuhil, but it's a dialect of that. And then everywhere you went, they were required to, you know, in Peru, they wreaked havoc, as they say. But with the English, the thing was to get rid of all of these guys, you know, take the land, have them as slaves, and then when that didn't work, you know, bring in black slavery. So I grew up in a place where Spanish was spoken as a second language, not English. And English was a third language. And of course, Guatemala, where I did live for so many years in the village of Santiago Tiplan, the language of the people was not Spanish, but it was Tutuhil Maya, and then almost everybody could speak 3 or 4 dialects of other Mayans, some of which are not mutually intelligible. And then the men, because of the commerce issue, they were some of them, and not all of them, but they were the ones who dealt with the outside world, outside their own zone, and they would speak some Spanish. But the Spanish they spoke was this most incredibly courteous 17th and 16th century Spanish, which is very similar in many ways to the Spanish being spoken in northern New Mexico today. So it's always been a mystery why these two places, you know, I didn't leave United States to go find Guatemala. I just ended up there, but I was always so mystified why they have so much love of the same things together. So as far as the cosmology, I'm not an anthropologist, so even though there are people that accuse me of it. And to talk about it from that objectified point of view, I think it's better to go on, and it will appear as time goes on, because the thing is, we don't have gods or goddesses in the strict sense, like, you know, the pantheist idea of Europe and India and all that. But there's a force that is constant and there all the time. And it's not like another world. It is this world, the other side of this same world. And so the maintenance of what it is we have here in this world, considering our world, is only a layer of a many-layered world, and it's our responsibility to keep our end up of it for all of the things that we remove from it. But the Mayans is based on feeding time as an entity, and they don't have a word for time, so it's called the walking of dawns and the walking of suns. And with the Pueblo people, one of the major differences is that the Pueblo people do not have the abundance of the land. They don't have the jungles, and they don't have so many trees. They have a definite winter here where everything dies back and it comes back alive, whereas in the tropics, it's a different story. So among the Pueblo people, they are also constantly having to feed with beauty through their rituals, their dances, all of the secret society rituals to heal, constantly healing the ground. They understand the human body is not being a reflection of the world, but being the actual world. So in English, you have the verb to be. German, you have a verb to be. You know, all of the Romance languages, you have a verb to be. And so your body cannot be the earth and be the land at the same time without it being sort of like an Escher thing. But in these other languages, there's no problem with it whatsoever. I remember seeing an anthropologist, and I like to poke fun at them because it's so much fun, because most of them hate me. But no, well, then, actually, the modern ones don't. They actually like me, but the old timers don't like me too much. Anyway, I saw him once in a sacred house in Atitlan, and I remember this one guy talking to this other, you know, official, and he says, "Well, now, what is this over here?" And the guy said, "Well, there's a sun, that's morning star, and that's the mother of life that lives in the moon, but whose body is the ocean." And he says, "Oh, you mean like the sun in the sky?" He said, "No, no, not like the sun. This is the sun in the sky." And the other guy said, "Well," the anthropologist says, "No, the sun is in the sky." He says, "Yes, the sun is in the sky. So what is this on this altar?" "That's the sun in the sky." And they say, "Well, how can it be in the sky in here?" And the guy said, "Yes, because if it has to be this or it's not, that it either is or in other words, to be or not to be is not a question. It's a to heal or in the language that I grew up in." It's a totally different mindset. And so this ends up being a giant philosophical problem for the other guys, where any two-year-old Sukhila understands that we don't need the metaphor in those cultures in order to have this enormous rituality. We have ritual instead of metaphors. Whereas in European languages, you've got to have metaphors to understand any of these big things. And I personally have a belief that this was not the case originally. I think that actually the Indo-European language was immensely amazing, a language of an immensely amazing people, but at some point in their history, something happened to cause them to become enormously afraid and schismed out their language. That's why I invented the school I have. That's what's all based on, trying to figure out when that happened and how things stopped being like that. Oh, sorry, I got carried away, but
no,
I always do. You know what you're getting into, you know, I mean, you read my book.
Well, it reminded me in your book when you were talking about plants as people and not as a metaphor, and that idea really stunned me in a beautiful way.
Great. Good to hear.
Yeah, and because planting the land is or was a sacred ritual all over the world with elaborate clothing and decoration, and
you know, the farm was a temple with sacred monuments. So perhaps you could describe for us this holy connection between plants and people, and how the Maya and Pueblo honor that connection.
Well, what is not the holy connection between plants and people? Because all flesh is plants. So basically, your whole body is made of plants, or somebody's body that you're eating was made of plants. I mean, plants are the most amazing thing. That's why I wrote a book on the, you know, on like a piece of Kuchumukip. Because with Mayan people, I mean, it's just, no one talks about it outside the culture, but because to them, it's not like something to talk about. It's just a known fact. And like I even wrote about it now. I remember marching around. I used to be a flute player in the village. Every time the old men and old women had to move somewhere on foot to go do whatever, you know, errand they had to do, they had to go with music. So it's always with the specific songs for specific rhythms of walking, going distance or going short distance. In the village, outside it. Anyway, I was always there. So I was going along, going along, going along, and these guys are really boiling hot, man. You because they heard about a bunch of young guys that went, decided they're going to be leftist guerrillas, and they're planting parliament, and they were just cutting down big old tons of hardwood trees, which were never supposed to be touched because it was supposed to belong to the holy beings of the mountains, and the place that people weren't even supposed to go except to make rituals, and they never lived there. So these guys were just sawing all this up and selling the lumber to German lumber companies. So the old people found out about it, and they were going to march up there and see if it was true, because they hadn't actually seen it with their own eyes. And on their way up there, we saw somebody had planted a great big old cornfield, big, beautiful corn show, the white corn. And all these guys that were so mad and had their machetes bristling and everybody was yelling, they all went to their knees and started kissing the field. Mm. And the field had been planted by their mortal enemies, next door, and they gave up and went home. Because once they saw that field and once they saw the corn and they realized it was their own ancestors and was growing out there, all of the folly of, human, I want it this way and I want it that way, just appeared from them because they recognized themselves. Because as far as they're concerned, they are plants. They are corn, their own self. So where I grew up, back to that again, back to old New Mexico, it's exactly the same thing. There are so many, even when we eat breakfast, like my little daughter today, she said something about she didn't want to eat the blue corn, she wanted red corn, because I grew all of my own plants here, all my food. And I said, oh, don't say that out loud, So what do you mean? So you're going to insult the mother of the one, and the other will be sad, and then her heart will fly out of her chest, and next time we plant, it won't grow. So we went down to where I got my blue corn growing, I got purple corn growing, some special breeds came from this old man. I got wrote about it, actually, in the book. And we're going down there, and they were all flagging, and they were all falling over. And she said, oh, I just insulted the one, and look at it. And then the red one, was fine. So, the people said, oh, well, that's folklore, that's cute. But you see, if you live in a relationship with the ground and the world in such a way that that is your consciousness, then you become more of a human being. So as far as plants being, genetically far from people, that's also nonsense, too. All you have to do is become a scientist, check out chromosomal levels, and you look at the genes. It's really not as far as you'd like it to be, So a plant is, not only are we totally dependent on it, but the monocultures have gotten to the point that when you're depending on something, it means it's your slave or your minion. Mm-hmm. Like, for instance, somebody works for me. Okay, that's a person that I'm paying, so they're lower than me. That doesn't work like that in native culture. Like, whatever is feeding you and is you're dependent on, that is your parent. That's your ancestor. That's the one that you kneel in front of. That's not the one that says, I own this. This is mine, man. Look what I got. I've got all these fields. I've got all this. I said, no, every time you see, you have to kneel and you piss and you think. Because what if you're killed or what if you die at that very moment? Then that beautiful way that you are at that moment is what you become upon your death. So the idea is by living in a certain way in these cultures that we're talking about, that you asked me about, in Mayan Tzotzil and the Kibo culture of this area, is that your life and then subsequently when you pass away, it's supposed to feed life so much that the present never dies. So the present gift of being alive in this particular time is called the belly button of time, and that is given life by the way you fall back to the earth. It's like a seed. So people and plant, they're like left and right foot at the same organism. And therefore, the way you live and the way you are, I got attacked one time by a bunch of guys who wanted to kill me in Guatemala. It's in another book. But I thought I got hit. I actually caught a piece of shrapnel, a ricochet off a wall in my sternum, made a little hole in there. It looked like I was shot through. And I started bleeding, and I thought I was killed because it was right over my heart. And so I said, no, I'm not going to go panic. I'm not going to go terrified. I just finished ceremony with my old teacher, Chi Li. I said, I'm going to be, just like you said, I got to be exactly what I believe in and what I am as I go out. So I got this great second chance because I wasn't shot through, but I was dying as far as I was concerned. So I was going to stay in one piece. With that same mentality of being this beautiful plant being going back in the ground to replant the present with my past husk. And so then it turned out I wasn't shot through. So, the lead was just stuck in my bone there. We pulled it out with the pliers and I was fine. I was terrified for the rest of my life. But nonetheless, it was a wonderful second chance for me to realize, you got to be that beautiful thing when you go down. And all those cultures have that. so that you live your life with that, and you don't live it for to get to a goal line. You live it so that at this very moment, as I kiss my corn, that's what I always want to be known for, you know, because she's my mother, and she's given life to my whole family.
I loved the chapter you wrote about the young men running to run versus...
They're running right now, this very minute that you're talking. They're running at this very minute out in the rain. Yeah.
Wow, that's it was running to run, not running to win, not running to get somewhere or, you know, to make money, but running for, you said, the deliciousness of it. It was such an incredible word, the deliciousness of running and living, for just the passion of life itself.
Why not?
And for me, as someone who was born in modern America, I feel alienated from the major spiritual traditions. I know very little about the practices of my blood ancestors, so I gravitate towards the messages of earth-based peoples, not to glue a veneer onto my tainted psyche, but because I reject the dominant culture and I recognize how deeply it's affecting the earth. I mean, the earth is changing under the weight of humanity. Habitat is disappearing. The most fertile lands are now paved under urban sprawl. The blood and the bones of the earth are being ripped from her. So, are there certain indigenous teachings, maybe the more practical side of things, that are being reimagined in light of this altered landscape?
First of all, an indigenous, from my point of view, when I use the word indigenous, I'm not talking about Mayans, I'm not talking about Pueblos, I'm not talking about any specific tribal peoples. I'm talking about from the point of view of the indigenous soul, which is not tribal specific. So it's a soul that I believe all human beings are capable of remembering given a good cultural surrounding. But in the sense that you say that it does not exist, that's sort of like an organ that is not really very well developed inside all human souls. Therefore, it is vestigial in most cases. And so it's like growing up eating McDonald's hamburger your whole life and then all of a sudden trying to develop taste buds. How much of it has been damaged and how much can be done? Well, I'm one of these hopeful idiots who keeps thinking, you know, it can be revived. And not only revived, but some things can show up that have never shown up before. So when I talk about indigenous, I'm not talking about something that was, that can be paved over, that can be imprisoned, can be killed. I'm talking about the thing that can't be killed, that can't be imprisoned, that can't be pulled in, because that's still the arrogance of Western society, thinking it's all powerful, thinking that it has, because the earth is bending under the weight of humanity. Well, there aren't humans, for one thing. There are people that should be trying to be humans. Second of all, the earth is enormously powerful, and humans keep thinking they're in charge of everything is pretty comical to anything that has the indigenous soul intact. The thing that people who are worried about it are so tied up with, I think, is the fact that they do want it their way. In other words, they want to be able to have an indigenous soul and still at the same time have all the comforts of the conqueror's society, you see, in place. And, I don't think that's actually possible. So what you're thinking of trying to adapt something that's indigenous to, and that's still also what you're saying is corroborating the idea that people have progressed and they have changed. But I don't believe in evolution in the change that things are going to an apex or that this particular time in life is what we were always trying to get toward. I think evolution is only change. and that what is indigenous is in constant change and constantly learning how to be new. This is why I wrote the book on the unlikely future Kuchumukik. I myself, you know, was terrified of all the GMOs and all this and all that. And then I saw these seeds bucket all by themselves without my permission, you know, come through it, and all of a sudden, there they are again. After, you know, if you have to read the book, there's quite a long story. But so as far as, you know, saying I don't want to co-opt and I don't want to litter the world by putting on a veneer, and yet I want my cake and eat it too, it's not possible to have those two things. So I think what I'm saying is that the grief level of finally recognizing the fact that humans are not here to succeed. Humans, if they are really, really, truly humans, are here to be an indigenous part of a bigger thing than themselves, and without them in charge. And then, of course, then you get all of the evangelical Christians say, yes, God is in charge, and that is definitely not what I'm saying. And then it's not just nature, you know, because nature, the designation of nature is also not just Western, but civilization's idea that you have nature and non-nature. An indigenous view is that there is no such thing as non-nature. That is only people trying to fortress themselves up so much with so many walls and so many ideas and so much armor to say, I am not that. And therefore they live in this eternal crumbling grief world that is always constantly in sight. So basically the world that you have now that is feeling, as you say, alienated as a bystander, is in flight away from being at home as an indigenous person. Well, you say, well, how can I be an indigenous person if I'm not tribal? How can I be an indigenous person if I don't know what that looks like? Well, first of all, that thing I, the I that doesn't know, is a good thing it doesn't know, because if it did, it would co-opt it. So the point is to be able to go into a grief level where the grief itself becomes pain. So the understanding and feeling so deeply the loss, not the loss of getting what you want, but the loss of what you love the most, so it comes down to love. Because if the taste buds of the tongue, the wiring in the ear, if the corona and the retina are not seeing fully what is out there, the only reason is because of the language that's being used. But as far as I'm concerned, the first and foremost place that has to be approached, could be approached, might be approached indefinitely, possible to approach, which is one of the big things, is with the language. And most people say, oh, I don't understand that. I said, well, of course not, because, you know, people aren't doing it. But you have, like, for instance, if you just try to speak for 1 year without using the word it, in other words, a baby colt wouldn't be an it. A baby child wouldn't be an it. A pup on your and your cupboard wouldn't be an it, and your car wouldn't be an it. You know, and you say, well, what would it be? Well, then, you know, normally you would get the more Tarzanic thing. You would say, my car, he's a good guy, or my car, she's a good thing. Well, people say, I already say that. Develop a third word that doesn't, or fourth word that doesn't mean that, so that you're no longer addressing the world as inanimate. And then the other thing is, instead of talking about the sun in the sky, talk to the sun in the sky. Mm. And then they say, well, then you're going to be locked up. Yeah, in Western culture, you would be. For instance, like, in Tutu Hills, it's great. Also, where I grew up, they will say, you know, like, when the sun comes up in the morning, everyone kneels, man, woman, child, or they go out and give gifts, because they know the sun is dying every day and it has to be fed. And the only reason it goes is for all the carbon unit that each human being takes out of the earth, it has to give something back to the sun so it moves in the sky. Western people say that's a belief. We know that it's science. So as soon as you're speaking, you don't use the word sun. It's like, Father, you say. You don't say, hey, there goes the sun. You don't speak as an objectified, like it's something there, a ball of fire or something like that. You say, oh, Father, it's good to see your face, good to feel your breath again. You know, I, your child, your daughter, your fruit, your sprout, the one that hangs on your tree. Jesus is the little baby bird trying to pick yourself out of the egg of night, you know, all those kind of things people say. And then goes. And then at nighttime when the sun is up there, you can use the word sun. But when you see the moon, you see grandmother. Do we see water? Call it my mother. You don't even use the word water in front of the water. And when you see a person in the street, you don't say, hey, Marge, how you doing? You say, hey, sister, or hey, auntie, or hey, you know, whatever relationship you might have. And if you don't know the relation, according to age, you figure it out what you think you should say, and vice versa with them to you. So the point is with language, when you get modern language, what we're calling modern language, which, you know, it's not that modern, but when it is already subverting the indigenous idea and creates instant depression because everything you're surrounded by is no longer related to you. So if you can just take one word and change that, and then you can get going and try to speak without the verb to be. Now, I personally like the verb to be, but I don't like to think that it's the only way to speak. You know, like if you say in Kewan, where I grew up, or in Tupuhir, you say, "This is a cat." You can't say that. And you can't say either, like there's no absolute no's or yeses. Like if someone says, "Would you like a cup of tea?" You can't say no. You can't say yes. You have to say, you have to describe what you mean. And you have a negative and positive forward moving phraseology. But if you say what I'm saying, as I'm saying to you right now, to modern people, they will say, "Oh, well, that doesn't going to do anything." But let them try it and see how their life goes. Because, you know, it changes everything. How you view the world is how you speak with and to and amongst one another. Because the main problem with modern people is the only thing that counts is people, and they don't care that much about them. Mm. So their interrelations between people are extremely sparse because they see them only as humans as opposed to animals and plants and celestial beings and stars and trees. And you could act like that, as you say, you know, and it wouldn't happen. But if you start to actually try to speak in your language, in other words, it's one thing to learn another language, because usually what you do when you learn another language, you just translate into your own language. You're not really actually speaking that language. But if you try to subvert English into an indigenous language, you might find something really different happening. So that's why I work with a lot of people with that. In the beginnings, I mean, mind you, so, yeah, but we need it this afternoon before the earth collapses. Well, you're not going to get it. You know, it's got to be slow. It's got to be gradual. Because if it's fast, it's the gringos that work again. Going too fast, killing the world. So it's going to be slow and beautiful. And there's lots of other places. I mean, another thing is food. I mean, it's one of the, there's two places. It's music and food. I mean, music is in Siberia, so it's food. But there is amazing customs and things with food that have leaked way back from our ancestors. Now, I'm not a big worshiper of ancestors, so I want people to know their ancestry. I want them to know their history. I want them to know where they're from, but not so they can get an identity, but so they can get a real identity that's different than their ancestry. But they can't do that as long as they're running away from their ancestry. And that's a conundrum. So as long as you're running away from your ancestry, you're going to constantly be what you came from. It's that old cowboy thing, you know. If the world is round, you get going fast enough, you end up sniffing your own butt, you know, because you're going so fast. I'm sorry, a little graphic, but we grew up with that stuff. With the food and music, you see, there are places there that go past all the nonsense of the head and go straight to the heart and straight to the body and the stomach. So with food and then music, of course, organic music, I mean, you know, not so much plugged-in music. But when you play music, you got to know how to make the instruments. You can't just grab an instrument and play the instrument. You got to make the instrument so you know everything about it. The thing is, if you dig, and if you try, and if you move, and you're willing to go slowly, and you're brave instead of wanting the answer and just sit in the lawn chair and hope the world goes your way, amazing things can happen. Mm-hmm. They're not going to get in the front page of any of the imperial rags, but they're going to be there, I'll tell you why. Mm-hmm.
You've criticized the New Age movement's appropriation and hollowing out of shamanic traditions. I'd love to hear your thoughts on that.
The great desire for wanting something that's not the same as these people have been raised with has to be given its due. I mean, I don't think people's desire for something deeper and ritual is bad, you know. And so a lot of the New Age, we're just kind of lumping it together. It's kind of a broad subject, just the New Age. And so it's basically people are going to go change the names of what they already know and then do the same thing over again. In other words, if their parents were not raised as, or maybe raised as Christians but didn't raise their children as Christians, or maybe their grandparents were Orthodox Jews but their grandchildren were not raised as Jews, still it's all implied inside the cultural way of going about things. And so as soon as you try to become a Buddhist or a South African Chamang, then you generally go about it in the way in which all spirituality has been treated since you were young, even though you're not recognized, you just basically change the words and act it the same. So even in that sense, you know, I mean, it's not such a terrible, terrible, bad thing. But when you start making up a ritual in order to accomplish something, then you're still manipulating phenomena, which is basically the tenement of technology. So shamanism, where I come from, is not a career. It's something that you get touched with and get called to do, and everybody goes kicking and screaming, no, I don't want to do it, I don't want to do it. But then you have to, because the Holy say yes. And what it is basically trying to give a place for the people when they're messing up, so that there's somebody who can advocate their case with the holies, so that they can make it heal again. That will only occur in proper situations, as far as I'm concerned, in a culture that has an intact relationship with nature or with the wild anyway. If you already have a people who are entirely, totally disconnected with their ancestral, with the ground, and as you put it, with nature, and then they're trying to be shaman, I don't know how many of these new age shamans, you know, that was coming to me and want me to teach them this and that. And I said, oh, no, learn how to be a person first, and then we'll go from there. They don't know how to raise cow. They don't know how to do this with chicken. They don't know how to tie a knot. They don't know how to ford a river. They don't know how to get through the trees up here. They don't know well enough not to go off. But shamanism is based on the natural things, the way they are, and all the myriad beauties of all the plants and animals. I always, first thing I say, how many feathers does a songbird have on its tail? And they all look at me like, what's that have to do with these? You gotta know. There's 10. Okay, how many does a raptor have? It's 12. And the big one says 13. And which one is the one you use for this? And they said, well, that's just something learned. I said, no, you gotta know all that stuff before your shaman. Little tiny kids know these things. So if you're gonna have urban shamanism, as they like to call it, then it's gonna be a shamanism of the modern culture in order to heal modern people, in order to keep them in the trenches with the insanity that's wrecking the earth in the first place. So it has no relationship whatsoever to that kind of shamanism. But the New Age thing is based basically on feeling powerful. Mm. And I really, you know, like, I never use the word power in relationship to any kind of healing. It's just shamanism is an anomaly inside the cultures that are intact. In other words, shamanism is not what those cultures are made of. Those cultures are made of people who are together and got it together. When they mess up, then they got to have an anomalous human being in there to help them to patch it up. But the farther and farther they drift, it can't be taught. It's just something that the natural world picks. It's like two warring tribes. You know, let's say, for instance, you have two tribes that are ancestrally related to one another. You know, sound familiar, you know? And they're warring, and they're at each other's throat. And let's say both sides pick this one being that they're willing to speak to the other. And that's basically what shaman is. But if you don't have the intactness to know what that is, then it's very difficult to just stand up one day and say, hey, I'm a shaman, I'm going to wave these feathers and you're going to be better. That's not to say that there aren't some people in all cultures, no matter where it's found, who have capacity. That's not what I'm talking about, because there are people who can heal, and there are people who can talk with holy, and there are people who do all kinds of things with the faith that they have, and that's great. So I'm not criticizing that. I just, when I do get a little sarcastic about all of the rituals that get made up and done, but a lot of damage is actually done. I used to go to men's conferences, you know, there were crazy guys like Robert Bly and Michael Mead and people like this to hire me. Actually, after I started, I didn't go to teach. They hired me in order to keep these guys from setting themselves on fire, blowing themselves up. Do I believe some of the crazy stuff they were doing? Because they were coming from they've gotten rid of their religion and their spirituality, which has some sort of idea of tradition, but was not really nothing anymore for them, apparently. And then all these guys coming out of war from Vietnam or whatever. And then they were making up rituals that basically came from group therapy and trying to make them look as if they were actually spiritual things. With natural peoples, I have to say this is what always very unpopular when I say it. You always hate me if they say it, but just as gently as possible. Any ritual that is done spiritually in a real tribe is never done for the people. It's never done for the people so that after the ritual is over, they say, wow, I feel a lot better. the whole idea is for the holy to feel better, because the holy has been mined and taken from and cut and holes dug in her. And the indigenous people think they're doing that too. They don't think they're outside that. You know, they don't say, oh, we're not Western, we're great, we're pure, we're clean, we don't do any of that. No, they feel they're the guiltiest of all, and so they spend all the time making risk in a holy well. They're trying to heal the earth, trying to heal the soul of the spirit. So they're not trying to heal the people, but the people are healed as a result, because they're the ones that are the benefactors of all of this great earth that is here, that has been giving us our food and our lives. So when you have all of these ritual things that are supposed to make you have an experience or feel something, it's just, you know, very amateurish that the people haven't been feeling these things by natural world. Otherwise, when they get up and eat their breakfast, they don't feel that exhilaration of just being alive like you're doing. You're a little kid in the world, and there's that tree, and there's all these plants, and the beautiful smell of the air, and oh my God, what's that cricket doing? And well, so maybe they don't have that. And so they're trying to find a spiritual way to jettison out of the muck in which they were born and raised in, and which they are still in collusion with by being this way. So I'm always saying, you know, best to learn how to become a people. Learn how to become a culture, and then if shamans are necessary, they will appear, and they will be legitimate within the cultures that appear. Martin Kreckel will not be the one to say what those cultures look like. But I will say, I think there's enough spiritual DNA in a human being of any place to regenerate it, given the condition.
And yeah. For so many people who are in the daily grind in urban life, who... maybe don't have the space to grow food, don't have the even the thought process to slow down and listen to that cricket.
Where an apple tree doesn't worry about who eats this apple, you know? Apple just keeps making apples. And it's not about getting to the place to where you can have that wonderfulness of being able to be with the cricket and all that. It's not about not having the space. It's about making the space. As I don't have this, or I don't know it, make it happen, you know, with yourself. Don't wait for it to happen. And another thing is that human success is still what you're talking about. You're still talking about, oh, wow, great. I am me as a person. I'm going to finally get this. No, that's still the conqueror talking. That's still imperialism. That's still me procuring something that I want and I need. And the one that I want is writhing in pain. The I that needs it is the one that's writhing in the pain. The reason it's writhing in pain is because of the fact it's that I, the one that wants it. And I'm not talking about the ego. I'm talking about this being that wants to possess instead of become the thing itself. And becoming it, how do you become it? You know, we talk about initiation, all that. You can't just put a person through a program and they become this. On the other hand, as I said, if you have faith that there is really a memorial process in the spiritual DNA of the human being, which I am just giving the name of indigenous soul, and if you allow that thing to live, then it may give forth something beautiful for the future. The thing is a capacity with grief. When you don't have a capacity with the grief as a modern person, then you cannot praise. So one of the greatest things is to be able to praise. And so what am I going to praise? I don't see anything worth praising. Yeah, that's the problem, what you're seeing, not with what there is to praise. There is always something worth praising in this earth. And there's always something beautiful to hear. It's just we're not hearing. Of course, you say, wow, the world is so like this. The world is so like that. Yeah, that's the challenge. See it. Hear it. I don't mean to say see the good in anything. I mean, you know, some guy is raping a woman. There's nothing good about it. Okay, I'm not talking about that. But I'm saying, see what there is to see. See what there is beautiful. And you say, otherwise, it's just laziness. And the culture is part of to be lazy. If it's not coming my way, it's the culture's problem. It's not coming my way, let me have a litigation so I can get paid for suffering. No. Make beauty. And so making beauty, the mysterious thing about beauty that I found in modern cultures really, they take a slim view of what I say is that that beauty comes only from a capacity with grief. Beauty does not come from anything but grief. Grief is not about being sad or sorrowful. Grief is about having the deepest emotion of missing what it is you love. And so if the thing that you love the most, you're missing, then you can praise by weeping and by feeling, and that actual ability to grieve then becomes the actual praise itself. The incapacity to grieve what we have lost as human beings by praising the beauty of it in itself is one of the biggest problems. But you become a human being, you can become a human being. You're in the process of bestowing on another what you yourself are never bound to receive. In other words, it's probably not popular to tell somebody you have to give to the youth what you never got. I'm not talking about money and I'm not talking about opportunity. I'm talking about recognizing, watching them like hawk, and then that one little time a 16-year-old actually sees the gorgeousness of the sunset on the sea and begins to weep, not for the angst of being a teenager, not for the sadness, but for the beauty of what they saw. And there's somebody a little bit older there who says, you know, what you're seeing is really, really worthy. And then begins to weep with them, not in a superior, condescending way, but side by side. Then people start to flower. And then they start to see the cricket. And then they start to make room for the things that need to be made room. And that's the only place there's ever revolution is going to happen that can stay. Because it's not made for people. People are not here to succeed at getting their way. As long as people have been getting their way, they're always in a big old mess. They're always in the big old mess. And you say, well, should I just be fatalist and give up? No, especially not that. It's not a to be or not to be problem again. No, be beautiful. Be beautiful. Be something that God would like to eat for breakfast. And then the world is replenished. And then you are renewed. But don't do it for that. Do it to make the world beautiful.
And
you walk on. I've got all these people I know. I've got a lot of students coming in. I've got 400 students. Jesus, I can't believe it. And some of them I don't know. Most of them I don't know. When the first days they come in with these faces that, you know, you could cut a shark in half of these faces. They're so angry about the way the world is. I said, you know, the world is not getting better by your ugliness.
Hmm.
You know, if I had you over for dinner, the fool would get up and run away. You know, for 5 seconds on earth, have beauty. And then there will at least have been 5 seconds where the earth isn't like what you hate. You know? Try it. You might like it. The environment is not concerned whether or not the redwoods go extinct or whether the sea rises or whether this plant goes dead. It's done that a million times before. It's the people that don't want it. The people who want to make all the money and are killing the earth and are raping all the environment and this, that, and the other thing. You can't have this big city and be in collusion and then have environmental concerns being approached by all kinds of programs and not have that be part of the same syndrome, the flip side of the coin that's making the problem.
Yeah.
That does not mean you shouldn't protest. It doesn't mean that you shouldn't try for environmental things, but you shouldn't. You should understand that is not an indigenous motive.
Mm.
For it to be different than that, you're going to have to be the thing itself that you want to happen.
Mm.
You can't just, go out and lobby and say, I paid my 5 cents, now I'm going to go home and be in collusion with the bullshit I'm against. So I'm thinking that in the original idea of your program, it's just that people are always trying to, quote, find an answer, find a bumper sticker, find a way to go. The point is that if you're only feeding humans, the holy is fleeing, and the holy is the core of what you're calling the environment, or something, I don't know if you're calling, but people call the environment. And as far as I'm concerned, I haven't found that to be making much of a difference. I don't think it's a bad thing to try and keep going, but it's just the same mentality as running a war. Are in the boardrooms of all these people, quote unquote, trying to have a win-win-win situation with the situation as it is, and still fight for environmental concerns, which basically makes it so people have a choreographed nature that they can go take a walk in while they still live in their monetized urban area. And that has nothing to do with, as far as I'm concerned, with loving the wild, and it has nothing to do with being an indigenous person. And a lot of indigenous people have given up being indigenous, and they're still called indigenous. So we don't want to confuse those two terms. It's two different things. But when it comes down to, it doesn't come down. When we come up to as an individual, very few people are courageous enough to do any things they say. But it's not going to kill anybody to give it a shot for a little while. or once a week, or 15 minutes a day or something, you know, to change their language or the way they dress or what they eat. Things will change a little bit that way. But the natural world has to be asked, and it has to be addressed. In other words, ask the cranes, the migrating cranes, then you'll be shaman, you see. Ask the earth itself, the people that say, well, we have to do something for the environment because we are in charge of the earth no matter what. Humans are in charge, humans are in charge, humans are in charge, humans are not in charge. The more they're in charge, the more the earth bucks. Everybody says, oh, the earth is falling apart. No, the earth is having a flu. It's having a big flu, man. It's trying to get rid of this bug. It's bugging them. And it's bigger than they are. It's this whole idea that humans are bigger than the earth. Yeah, but look what's happening. If you look what's happening, you're getting ready to sink into it and die. That's what's happening to it. And the earth will continue on, and the universe will too. And, I mean, protest bad things. You know, the pipeline through here, protesting it. The road through here, protesting it. Poisoning the river. Protest all of it. But don't confuse that with a spiritual approach. Okay? And it doesn't mean that it's separate from that, but as you have the spiritual thing, you have the wherewithal to do the other. But any changes that happen are still for people. It's not for the holy. And the people don't want to hear, what do you mean holy? There's no holy. You mean Jesus? No, not Jesus. You mean Yahweh? No, I don't mean Yahweh. I mean something you don't know. Doesn't matter. You don't have to know. It's inside every speed. So it makes life bust loose and live. You reflect and then we die. Yeah, then we live something so it keeps going. Different vision of time. Mm. The indigenous past never leaves. That's the other thing. Like, past tense, you don't have a past tense or a future tense in most of these indigenous languages that are finite. Like, when somebody dies, they never leave. It's always here. Like, there's a tribe, and what is it, 2 weeks from now, next door to us up here in another Pueblo tribe, they're all going to go back where they came from, you know? The whole entire tribe goes, you know, 6,000 people goes, they disappear into this lake where they originated from, and they come out the same day that they originated, which is, you know, 20,000 years ago. And then a gringo say, well, you can't really do that. Ask one of them Indians. Yeah, and they come back home, and they start their lives up, and as far as they're concerned, every year, it's the first year of existence. So, you know, it's different time understanding.
Is time another language barrier?
Well, time is language. That's exactly what it is. And the problem is in Western languages, you have to develop astrophysics to even talk about it. But, you know, if you're talking about the things that they're talking about in astrophysics, you can say those in Mayan when you're 5 years old. All that stuff. It's not that abstract or difficult to understand because it's not mathematical. It becomes something totally amazing. So it's very important. People say, well, then all I have to do is learn another language. Well, that would be good as long as you actually learn it, but you can't actually learn it if the grooves of your mind are already cut with the language that you grew up with. It's only certain extraordinary people that can make that jump. So that's why I say it's better to subvert the language you already have with these ideas so that, you know, you start cutting new grooves. You know, when you have a verb to be, you have, they used to call it in the old days, although the rhetoric was linear time. And what you have in a lot of indigenous languages, you have what it would be called a spherical time. You have, like, and when you're riding in your mother's belly as a fetus, you're surrounded by the amnios. And that, in Mayan thinking, amnios, the word for the amniotic fluid is time. In other words, you're floating in that time. And what is that time made of? Well, it's salty, you know, it's full of minerals. And I call it stars. I call that stars. And the stars, they're all time combined. In other words, things that used to happen or did happen are there. Things that are going to happen are there. Things that are happening are there. Things that are never going to happen are there. Things that we wanted to happen in the old days are there and never happened. So they're all floating in this gigantic soup of the ocean of time. And so as a small child inside your mother's belly, you're living in this mixed time altogether instead of it being a linear beginning to end time, you see. Then you're born into this world with the air breathing from the water, and then you get sequential time. You see, you know, when things happen after one, after the other, after the other, after the other, after the other. But they are totally fed by this great big, what they call ocean of time. And so this is like, everybody calls it a mentality, but, you know, that's just the way that people speak and think. It's not like, you know, something you got to go to school to learn. It's like everybody knows it. And so it's inherent in the language. And modern language, I think, is for some reason drifted away from some ancient understanding of time because they stopped being nomads. At some point when they were ancient nomads, they had a totally different thing of time because they're always constantly moving. And when they moved, they didn't like move away from where they were. They move in cycles back to where they were. And so I think ancient European languages actually did have a pretty good grasp of time. But once everybody becomes settled, it's just like this geologist told me one time, it's like the rug at the front of your house where the dog keeps running out, you know, keeps wrinkling up, wrinkling up, wrinkling up. First thing, you just have this gigantic mass blocking the door. And instead, if you spread this gigantic, beautiful rug out, you'll see all of the permutations of time and life lived all in one place at the same time, not one before the other. And so when it comes down to hope, if you have that kind of understanding of time, then all of this very depressive, you know, well, look what we're doing to the earth and things, which is very true. I'm not putting it down. I'm not saying that. But that's why it's happening, because people are always trying to find the answers. Everybody who's making a war thinks they're right. You know, no one's making a war because they think they're wrong. They're only making a war because they think they're right. And one is doing this and doing that because they're right. They're good guys and the bad guys and the left and the right, they all think they're right. Instead of seeing what is there and the big time and the big mind and then trying to be one of those little pieces of the stitching in that gorgeous rug of time so that you do your part not to make it a big tear. So I don't have time, make time.
Mm-hmm.
What are you doing with that time? The coffee shop being depressed, forget it, go out and do it.
It is really easy to get depressed.
Yeah, it's a sport.
Oh, it is. Yeah, and I
highly paid sport.
Yeah, that's very true. It's very highly
paid. You can
be
depressed as much as you want when you're dead. So don't waste your time being depressed now. Because once you're dead, you can be depressed all the time if you want. You know, I've seen everything I had shot down before me. I lost 19 friends in 45 seconds. I've been shot in the chest myself. Lost my whole culture twice over. And people say, "How come you're still happy?" So, man, I'm not letting the enemy take me down. Not smiling. Mm-hmm. You know. And because otherwise, they win. Invite the fascist owner to dinner, man.
Oh, that's...
Don't eat alone.
Thank you so much, Martin.
If you're sad more than 2 days in a row, you ate something bad or you're thinking something weird.
Thank you for listening to Unlearn and Rewild. I'm Ayana Young. You heard the guitar music of Robbie Basho, two tracks, Blue Corn Serenade and Kawaka Damore. Our theme song is Like a River by Kate Wolf, and our producer is March Young.